Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. Today marks the 15th anniversary of the invasion of Afghanistan by the United States and Britain. The start of what was called Operation Enduring Freedom came less than a month after the attacks of 9/11. And ushered in George W. Bush's war on terror that led to the U.S. occupation of Iraq starting in March 2003. But today, the Taliban that the U.S. removed from power controls more territory in Afghanistan than it actually did in 2001, and almost 10,000 U.S. troops remain in the country. Will the United States ever actually withdraw from Afghanistan? To talk about these issues, we are joined for the full hour today by Peter Kuznick. He is a professor of history at American University and co-author with Oliver Stone of The Untold History of the United States. In our first segment, we'll also be joined by Dr. Jacob Diliberto, a researcher at the University of Birmingham and an Iraq and Afghan war veteran. In our second and third segments, we'll be joined by Jeremy Kuzmarov, assistant professor of American history at the University of Tulsa, whose latest book is Modernizing Repression, Police Training, and Nation Building in the American Century, and by Brian Terrell, a longtime peace activist and co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, who has organized many solidarity trips to Afghanistan.
Hello.
Hello. Thanks very much.
Jacob, let's start with you. It was 15 years ago today that the U.S. and Britain invaded Afghanistan. You were part of the operation with the U.S. Marines, Operation Enduring Freedom. Talk about what you did, what your expectations were, and as you look back sort of in a brief way in these last 15 years, what's the main lesson that you draw?
Well, I recall after 9/11, the United States took the 26th Marine Expeditionary Unit and the 15th Marine Expeditionary Unit, along with a few small U.S. Army components, and went after the Taliban and went after small bases of al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. Our role originally was to set up Fob Rhino and Pazni and a few other small air bases in Jacobabad and then also in all over Pakistan to set up the initial wave of U.S. forces. Interesting enough, that those preliminary missions went fairly smoothly, fairly successfully, and the rout of the Taliban over the next year was imminent and was done with very, very little civilian casualties. Over time, there was deterioration of U.S. efforts because the Iraq war really distracted U.S. logistical support, U.S. Central Command, intelligence assets, and also a huge amount of U.S. forces that could be deployed to further stabilize the new government. And as a result, you know, later on, here we are 15 years later, you know, surge one and two and a whole host of other problems. And there hasn't been the end goal of stabilizing Afghanistan from the top to the bottom. I guess if I look back at it, I'd say there's been some good and some bad, but generally speaking, it's an incomplete mission with still an incoherent direction for the foreseeable future.
Peter Kuznick, why did the U.S. invade Afghanistan? Why is it still in Afghanistan? I was reading an article that was published in Politico a little while ago. It said 12 days after 9/11 on September 23rd, 2001, CIA Islamabad station chief Robert Grenier received a telephone call from his boss, George Tenet. "Listen, Bob," Tenet told him, "we're meeting tomorrow at Camp David to discuss our strategy on Afghanistan. How should we begin?" The CIA station chief in Islamabad then sent him an 8-page memo about what to do. But in fact, the Pentagon and different units of the Pentagon seem to be relatively uninterested in the mission. In other words, the article is making the point that it was a murky mission from the beginning.
Well, you really need to make sense out of Afghanistan. We need to trace it back much, much earlier. The U.S. involvement there begins in a serious way back in 1978. We're talking about the Carter administration at the time when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan. And so, I mean, the history is much more complex. And to really make sense of it, we need to trace it back further. The specific question you're asking before we get into some of the back history is why we invaded in 2001. And that ostensibly was because Al-Qaeda was operating out of Afghanistan. They had safe haven in Afghanistan. And after the attack on 9/11, the United States pledged to go into Afghanistan and to rout the Taliban as well as Al-Qaeda. We gave the Taliban the option of turning over Osama bin Laden and the leaders of Al-Qaeda. And we gave them a short period of time, gave them the ultimatum. Finally, the United States invaded. But even that period is much murkier. According to, we know that the Americans and the Taliban in Afghanistan were meeting, that there were at least 20 high-level meetings during that time, at which there was a discussion about turning over bin Laden. The Taliban was open to doing so. They actually offered to send bin Laden to the Organization of the Islamic Conference for trial by them, but the United States wanted to do the trial itself. So the negotiations were going back and forth. According to Milton Bearden, who was the former CIA station chief who oversaw the 1980s covert war in Afghanistan from Pakistan, he said that U.S. inflexibility and obtuseness was really to blame. He says, we never heard what they were trying to say. We had no common language. Ours was give up bin Laden. They were saying, do something to help us give him up. And so according to Bearden, CIA station chief, they were happy to give him up, but they needed the United States to work with them to give them some kind of face-saving way of doing so. But the United States was much more inflexible in its approach. So in some ways, we could have achieved our goal there without the invasion at all. Now, we're talking about an invasion that's lasted 15 years, that's cost us over $800 billion. That's created a situation, as you say, in which the Taliban now control more than they did back then. The Taliban control approximately 20-25% of the districts in Afghanistan today. That's after 15 years of war, hundreds of billions of dollars being spent, thousands of lives being lost. So there was a policy that was ill-conceived from the beginning and that Obama has doubled down on, or at least doubled down on initially, and then finally decided that we were going to withdraw. In 2011, he announced we'd be out by 2014, but then he reneged on that, and we've got 8,500 or so troops there still.
Jacob DiLiberto, the Taliban did offer to send Osama bin Laden for a trial to the Organization of Islamic Conference if the U.S. would provide evidence, to which George W. Bush said, we don't negotiate with terrorists. Now, according to the 9/11 Commission report, of the 19 hijackers who carried out the attacks on September 11th, 15 of them were Saudis. None of the people there were Afghans. Here we are 15 years later. Tens of thousands of Afghans have died. There was a poll taken in the southern part of the country by Western news media organizations a few years ago. 92% of the people, I think in Kandahar province, said they had never heard of the World Trade Center, much less the 9/11 attacks. In other words, the people in Afghanistan weren't responsible, but they are paying a very, very heavy price.
Yeah, that's true. It's interesting you say 92% of the people in Kandahar haven't heard of World Trade Center. It's also probably fair to say that 92% of the people in Kandahar probably also haven't heard of Baghdad. So it's a rural part of the country. The largely illiterate part of the country, outside of your own village and valley, there's not a large, huge experience. You know, majority of Afghans haven't gone on Hajj. So it's fair to say that Afghans and their connection to 9/11 is, you know, essentially zero, with the exception of, you know, housing a few Saudi militants. I just wanted to make my point, though. It's interesting enough that when bin Laden was operating in Sudan, he was invited to come to Afghanistan. He was invited to come by one of the Taliban sheikhs. I forgot his name. But because of the invitation to go back, there was refuge given to bin Laden and Saudis as well, and many Saudis as well. So when the Bush administration said, we don't want to negotiate with terrorists, there was basically an error made there that was conflicting a tribal ruling body, the Taliban, and associated them as being as international terrorists. And we didn't have any sort of legal parameters in which how to differentiate al-Qaeda and the Taliban. And we maintained that position all the way up until 2011. So the United States is, not only did we fail in terms of how we structured the war on terror, we failed in how we identified our enemy or our mission goals or ends. We failed across the policy platform from top to bottom and maintained that failure up until the present day. I think the key difficulty in the upcoming years is going to be trying to figure out from the State Department level, Department of Defense level, what is our plan in the future? What do we want to do? And will we learn from the mistakes we made in the past? Because clearly the United States, as the other caller mentioned, we've been having a series of failures in Afghanistan since the 1970s, and we haven't really changed much at all.
Peter Kuznick, in your opinion, why is the U.S. still in Afghanistan, and why are they announcing, why is the Obama administration and certainly the subsequent coming administrations announcing that they don't intend to leave? Is it because Afghanistan constitutes a geostrategic sort of prize, something that would be valuable for the U.S., or is it just that the Obama administration or any administration doesn't want to be perceived as having been defeated in Afghanistan should they exit, and if the Taliban were to take over, then they would have the responsibility? In other words, as Nixon and Kissinger kept the war in Vietnam going long after they knew it was lost because they didn't want to take responsibility for a defeat, is that the motivation, or is there a bigger geostrategic sort of calculation by the United States? Of course, it's a very important part of the world.
It's probably a combination of the two. And clearly, the American presidents and administrations and policymakers don't want to be perceived as weak, don't want to ever admit to losing wars. Obama seems less driven by that, perhaps, than to other American political leaders over the years. There's also a geostrategic interest involved. We've known about the resources in Central Asia throughout the 20th century. If you check the early reports, we were not caught unawares that there was tremendous mineral wealth in that region. We know that UNICAL and others were very much concerned about building pipelines there. UNICAL was working with the Taliban and applauded the Taliban victory because the Taliban was open to working with UNICAL in order to get some of those resources in the region. So there's a lot of competition to get the resources, and that's a factor also. But just geostrategically and geopolitically in the world now, the United States has not been in a very strong position. It's clear, as Jake was saying, that the United States can destroy things. The question is, can the United States build things? And it's easy for us to defeat an enemy militarily. It took us no time at all to vanquish the Taliban and al-Qaeda in Iraq in 2001. That was the easy part. It was actually winning the peace that was much more difficult. The same thing in Iraq. In our planning for what to do after those regimes were toppled, after the military victory initially, is where we faltered. So the question of building something positive to replace those administrations was our complete failure. In Iraq, there was very little thought given to it by the Bush administration. In Afghanistan, we've floundered also. You look at it, for example, in 2011, the United States spent over $100 billion on the military effort, but only $2 billion on sustainable development. So we've got a situation in Afghanistan when at the time when the Soviets moved in there back in 1978, or when the government, the Soviets moved in 1979, but the pro-Soviet government took power in 1978, the New York Times reported that the average life expectancy in Afghanistan was 40 years. That fewer than 10% of the population was literate. The situation now, perhaps, is a little bit better in certain ways, but still over 3/4 of the population is illiterate. And this is after 15 years of American involvement. Life expectancy is still very low. The poverty rates are still very, very high in Afghanistan. So So in terms of, you can point to some limited advances. There's more schools now. A slightly higher percentage of women are attending schools. But the overall situation there is still quite dismal. And the government, if you look at the government there, it is still mired in corruption. For years, Afghanistan has been at the top of the corruption index. Some years number one, some years number two. I haven't seen the latest one, but the corruption level is still out of control. And the concern is that there is actually a lot of support for the Taliban in many parts of the country because of the corruption, inadequacy, cruelty, incompetence of the Afghan leadership. So we can stay there. You know, you ask how long we're going to stay there, what the projections are. There's almost no scenario by which we win this thing militarily. So then the question is, what kind of negotiations do we have? Can we continue? Can we find some kind of resolution with the Taliban leadership? And then that brings in the whole question of Pakistan, which is further complicates it, and we can get into that as well.
That was the voice of Peter Kuznick. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. We're talking about the 15th anniversary of the U.S.-British invasion of Afghanistan. To talk about the issues, we're joined for the full hour by Peter Kuznick. He is a professor of history at American University and co-author with Oliver Stone of The Untold History of the United States. We're also joined in this segment by Jeremy Kuzmarov, assistant professor of American history at the University of Tulsa, whose latest book is Modernizing Repression, Police Training, and Nation Building in the American Century, and by Brian Terrell, a longtime peace activist and a co-coordinator of the Voices for Creative Nonviolence, and they have organized many solidarity trips to Afghanistan. Welcome, Peter, Jeremy, and Brian.
Hi, Brian.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
Brian Terrell, let's start with you. You've been to Afghanistan many times. It's 15 years later. There were no Afghans who were on the planes that attacked the World Trade Center or the Pentagon. Most people in the southern part of Afghanistan, at least, never even heard of the World Trade Center, according to a media survey that was conducted by a Western media outlet. And yet tens of thousands of Afghans have died or been injured. Many millions have been affected directly. People have been displaced. When you've been to Afghanistan, what do you see?
My first visit was in 2010, and I was there twice last year. The last time was last November, and I hope to go there again next month. The situation has just deteriorated. It's an embarrassment that the U.S. own Inspector General for the Reconstruction of Afghanistan has said that noted that more U.S. and allied money has been spent on reconstruction alone in Afghanistan and the whole Marshall Plan that rebuilt Europe, Western Europe, after World War II. And yet the situation has only deteriorated. Most of that money has never even gotten there. And one of the things they discovered is that of 641 healthcare facilities that the USAID claims have been funded, built and funded with our taxpayer money, 510 of them cannot be located. They don't know where they are. That's 80%. So it's also distressing to see. We go there and we work with young people, and we note the effect of post-traumatic stress, of moral injury of our soldiers who go there. But you have a entire nation now. Most of the people who were born in Afghanistan, most people in Afghanistan today were not born before all these wars started, who have been tremendously traumatized. Hardly anybody has not been a victim of violence or not been a witness to horrendous things. And it just is a very difficult thing to try to rebuild a society after it's been, treated so horribly over all these years.
Yeah. Let's bring Jeremy Kuzmarov into the discussion. Jeremy, President Bush said in his speech announcing the military operation, Operation Enduring Freedom, that began today, 15 years ago, he said, quote, "The oppressed people of Afghanistan will know the generosity of America and our allies. As we strike military targets, we will also drop food, medicine, and supplies to the starving and suffering men and women and children of Afghanistan." A very noble sounding, but here we are 15 years later. The people in Afghanistan live under occupation. They don't want to be occupied. They might not have liked, and certainly many of them did not like, the Taliban in 2001. But now the Taliban controls more territory. Their popularity seems to be up in some areas, at least because the Karzai government and then it's the subsequent government that took its place is so corrupt, and because they're seen as these fighters against the foreigners. Talk about it, if you would.
And actually, I would quote, what Bo Bergdahl was saying. I think people need to listen to what he was saying.
And remind the audience who Bo is.
Well, Bo was a deserter. He's been court-martialed for alleged treason. But he wrote these correspondence with his father that, pointed to his deep misgivings about the war. And he said his experience, I think he personally had good intentions when he joined the military. But he said in a letter to his father that his experience was one of deception. And that he was, quote, "sorry for everything here. These people need help, yet what they get is the most conceited country in the world, telling them that they are nothing and that they are stupid and have no idea how to live." So I think that says a lot about perhaps the mentality of superiority when the Western countries go into these nations, when they look down on the people and often treat them badly. It undercuts any humanitarian initiatives that they may be undertaking. And then we also have to look critically at who the United States is supporting when they're supporting a government governments that have been allied with these brutal regional warlords who oppress women, who are implicated in the narcotics trade. This is obviously going to facilitate a backlash among the population that helps to explain the strength of the Taliban, which, as you suggest, is stronger now than ever before.
Peter Kuznick, I want to pick up on what Jeremy talked about, because there is a lot of racism. I know, because I've talked to a lot of Iraq and Afghan war veterans. I've been part of and helping to organize the anti-war movement, and many soldiers and Marines and sailors have come into the anti-war movement. And one of the things that always strikes them, especially those who went with idealistic notions, they went to liberate, as George W. Bush put it, to liberate the oppressed people in Afghanistan. But what they encountered was systematic, thorough, comprehensive racism dished out by the brass and by others in the U.S. military against the people who they were supposedly liberating. And the Afghan people are a proud people. They don't want to live under occupation. You quoted CIA station chief Milt Bearden in their first segment, because he was the CIA field officer in Afghanistan overseeing the operations from 1986 to 89. I want to read a quote to you because I think it speaks directly to this. He says, this is Milt Bearden, CIA, quote, "My touchstone is historian Louis Dupree, one of the really great thinkers on Afghanistan. Dupree said that there were four mistakes the British made in Afghanistan." And of course, the British had occupied it. "One, they occupied it. They put their own hated emir on the throne. They knocked down doors and killed people, then stopped paying their friends. We have followed the same pattern. It didn't work for the British. It's not working for us." Go ahead.
Well, you can cite also the Soviet operations in Afghanistan. The Soviets, like the Americans, had over 100,000 troops there. When Brezhnev went in there in 1979, he said it was going to take 3 to 4 weeks for them to defeat the Afghans, to put down the insurgency. After a decade, the Soviets left with their tail between their legs, and it had a devastating impact on the Soviet Union and was one of the factors that led to the collapse of the Soviet Union. So there has always been this tendency to overestimate the ease with which we can secure a victory in these situations. That's one of the lessons that Robert Gates learned. It doesn't seem to be a lesson that Hillary Clinton has learned. Robert Gates, when we were talking about bombing Syria, Robert Gates was opposed to that, actually. And he said, "Haven't we learned anything from our invasions of Afghanistan, Iraq, and Libya? These are the things always have unintended consequences. They never go the way they're planned." And yet Hillary Clinton is doubling down on this kind of militaristic response to situations and military solutions to problems. But that's a tendency that goes way back. If you look at America's history, at least since Vietnam, the easy victories that we had once hoped for, we can go back to Korea. The United States has not been able to prevail in these kinds of situations through military means, which is more reason why we've got to find another way to approach this and another way to solve these problems, because the military solutions seem to make the situations worse time after time after time.
Yeah, very true. I mean, the United States fought in Korea. They could not destroy North Korea, which was their goal when they invaded the northern half of the peninsula. They left 3 years later. There's still no peace treaty. The Korean War is still technically on. The U.S. lost the war in Vietnam. The U.S. lost the war in Iraq. The U.S. destroyed the Libyan government. But what have they gained? ISIS controls a big part of the country, and they've helped fragment Syria. To what end? I mean, I hear what you're saying. Brian Terrell, the U.S. Doesn't seem to be succeeding with all of these military adventures, and they're bipartisan. It's Republicans and Democrats. And yet they keep going and going and going. Now, when President Obama was elected in November 2008 and when he took office in January 2009, people thought, hey, the Bush era is ending. It's not just that Bush is leaving, but the Bush era, the war, the era of endless war is over, is ending. But now you have Obama announcing an open-ended campaign, the long war, both in Iraq and in Syria, handing it off to the next administration. In other words, it really has become George W. Bush and Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld's vision, and it's now incorporated, institutionalized, and it's both parties.
Yes, and it's Dick Cheney was quoted in early 2002 about the war in Afghanistan, and he said this war on terror is one he didn't think would ever end. He said it would become a permanent part of the way that we live. And I think that's, you know, that's really been almost accepted by both main political parties. We've had the longest running war ever, and it's there isn't any kind of will to end it. And as we see with the Inspector General's report and what's happening on the ground in Afghanistan, where today even the embassy staff doesn't travel on the roads. They're ordered to go only by helicopter from helipad to helipad. The situation is so dire. And the so-called humanitarian aid that's been going on is simply another method of warfare against the people of Afghanistan and the people of the other areas like this. With this anniversary, I can't help but think of Whiteman Air Force Base in Missouri, which is the headquarters for the stealth bomber program. The first bombs to explode over Kabul on the 7th of October 2001 were B-2 stealth bombers that flew from the middle of Missouri, and they had 40-hour, these missions lasted 40 hours, and they had to refuel every 6 hours in the air, two crews on each plane. It was grueling, and Whiteman Air Force Base is very proud of that they were the first ones to attack that country who'd done us no harm. And today at Whiteman Air Force Base, their missions flown over Afghanistan 24 hours, 7 days a week by drones, by people who are sitting in offices, who take 8-hour shifts and relieve each other, get up from the chair and somebody else sits down. So what's happened in the meantime with the Obama administration is that war has become so much easier, so much more convenient. So I'm afraid it's just getting more and more prevalent.
Yeah, Jeremy Kuzmarov, I want to stay with you about the history of the U.S. in Afghanistan. Now it's 15 years. They say the U.S. government says it's really there forever. Same with Iraq, same with Syria. But in the first segment, Peter Kuznick was talking about how the U.S. first got involved in Afghanistan, and it was after the takeover, a coup d'etat or a revolution, however one characterizes it, by a socialist party. It was called the People's Democratic Party of Afghanistan, PDPA, and that was in April 1978. They announced, even though they said they were communists, they announced what was essentially democratic reforms. Women should be able to go to school. There should be a minimum wage. There should be land reform, basic sort of demands that have been already sort of achieved in most of the Western countries. But because they were aligned with the Soviet Union diplomatically, and because they called themselves communists, they became the targets not only for the Mujahideen and the people in the villages, the old sort of patriarchal villages who opposed these kind of reforms. They also became the focus, the target of a major CIA covert war operation that was called at that time the largest CIA operation to date up until that time. Eventually, the government, the Progressive People's Democratic Party of Afghanistan government, weakened by factionalism, required or helped or asked for the Soviets to come in to assist them. Then the Soviets were there. But talk about, Jeremy, talk about why the United States has to target any government that proclaims itself to be socialist. Certainly, the People's Democratic Party of Afghanistan-led government wasn't a real threat to the United States. And why then did they call Osama bin Laden a freedom fighter, which is what they did, what the U.S. government did?
Well, I think historically, perhaps it relates to the threat of a good example. You know, even if a country may not be so wealthy itself as far as its own resources, there's a threat of a good example. If socialism succeeds in a country like Afghanistan, it could provide a model for other developing world countries, and that could undercut U.S. power in the world and U.S. Investment opportunities and influence. So that may be a reason. There's also just, you know, pure geopolitics, the United States not wanting the Soviet Union or the Russians to gain an edge, just like in Syria today. That may be a key factor why the U.S. is heavily involved today in Syria. So I think it's, you know, geopolitics and that threat of a good example that leads to the U.S. intervening historically all around the world to roll back socialism. And, you know, in the case of Afghanistan, we know from what Brzezinski said, Carter's national security advisor, that the U.S. actually was wanting to induce a Soviet invasion. So they'd have their own Soviet, they'd have their Vietnam, and that would undercut the Soviet empire, which indeed in many ways did come to pass. So that's interesting as well, aspect of the history.
Peter Kuznick, we're gonna pick up that same theme. We're gonna go in a moment for a break. We're talking about the 15th anniversary of the U.S.-British invasion of Afghanistan. We're gonna follow this up in our final segment, talking about the geopolitics, the overarching U.S. strategy, who benefits from this war, and of course, will there be an end to the war? You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. We're talking about the U.S.-British invasion of Afghanistan 15 years ago today. To talk about the issues, we're joined for the full hour by Peter Kuznick. He is a professor of history at American University and co-author with Oliver Stone of The Untold History of the United States. We're also joined by Jeremy Kuzmarov, assistant professor of American history at the University of Tulsa, whose latest book is Modernizing Repression, Police Training, and Nation Building in the American Century, and by Brian Terrell, a longtime peace activist and co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. He has, along with his group, organized many solidarity trips to Afghanistan. Peter Kuznick, let's go back. Let's talk about why the U.S. orientation towards the socialist government in Afghanistan that came to power in 1978, why they targeted it, what were the concerns? Talk about that.
As Jeremy was saying, this is an interesting and complicated situation. In April 1978, pro-Soviet rebels led by Nur Muhammad Taraki and Hafizullah Amin seized power. Even though they were pro-Soviets, the Soviet government was not supporting them. Soviet government was getting along fine with the people who had been in power earlier. But there was strong opposition to the new government, and that was largely these warlords and Mujahideen. And what they were opposed to was that the new government was instituting educational programs for women, land reform, and industrialization. And that's what antagonized the Mujahideen, these Islamist holy warriors, largely operating out of Pakistan. And then the civil war began. The U.S. intervenes long before the Soviet invasion, which is what most people don't understand. The U.S. got involved back in July of 1979, months before the Soviet invasion, to support these people, these mujahideen, whose main gripe against the new government was that they were educating and giving rights to women. And so we support these mujahideen. Brzezinski, who had by this point had a lot of influence over Carter, initially Carter resisted getting involved. But then Brzezinski writes, he said, it was July 3rd, 1979, that President Carter signed the first directive for secret aid to the opponents of the pro-Soviet regime in Kabul. At that very day, I wrote a note to the president in which I explained to him that, in my opinion, this aid was going to induce a Soviet military intervention. So what the Soviets were concerned about was that the Afghan insurgency would spark an uprising by the 40 million Muslims in Soviet Central Asia. But Brezhnev didn't want to get involved. He knew that if they did get involved, it was going to destroy the SALT II negotiations, détente with the West, and that's exactly what happened. So finally, under pressure, Brezhnev does send the Soviet troops in there, and then Carter responds in exactly the way that Brzezinski had hoped he was going to respond, and with this blanket denunciation of the Soviet Union, saying this is the worst thing that's happened since World War II. And U.S.-Soviet relations do fall apart at that point. The United States begins this operation. So we, even though publicly we decried the outrage that the Soviets would invade, privately we applauded it. We were happy. As Jeremy was saying, Brzezinski wanted to give the Soviet Union its own Vietnam, and that's basically what happens there, although not quite on the scale of Vietnam. And then over the next few years, we support this massive covert operation, in which we're working with the Pakistanis. You have to remember that Carter had cut off all aid to Zia in 1977 because of his human rights abuses, because it was such a reactionary regime. Not only then we change our policy, we start supporting Zia, and working with Pakistani intelligence, with Saudi funding, we begin to support this insurgency. And these Islamists stream in there. You've got the money going to the madrasas in Pakistan who are indoctrinating in radical Islam. And these people are being recruited for jihad. We're sending billions of dollars in there to support this. And we support this insurgency. But this insurgency, the people we're supporting, like Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, these are the most anti-women, most reactionary and vicious leaders. Hekmatyar, who we're supporting, is known for doing two things. One is for going in the bazaars in Pakistan and throwing acid in the faces of women who are not covered up enough. And the other thing he's known for is skinning prisoners alive. These were our allies there. As Cheryl Bernard...
Peter, let me just interrupt. I think the Afghan government just signed a peace agreement with him.
Yes, they did just sign an agreement with him. But these are the kinds of people. Cheryl Bernard, whose husband was Zalmay Khalilzad, the former U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, she said, "We made a deliberate choice. At first, everyone thought there's no way to beat the Soviets. So what we have to do is to throw the worst crazies against them we can find. And there were a lot of collateral damage. We knew exactly who these people were, what the organizations were like, and we didn't care. Then we allowed them to get rid of, just kill, all the moderate leaders. The reason we don't have moderate leaders in Afghanistan today is because we let the nuts kill them all. They killed the leftists, the moderates, the middle-of-the-roaders. They were just eliminated during the 1980s and afterwards." So this massive undertaking, beginning under Brzezinski and then under Casey and Reagan, simply created a situation in which these crazies who we were supporting killed the moderates, and these extremists took power, later creating a vacuum after the Soviets leave and the Taliban move in.
Okay, that's Peter Kuznick. Brian Terrell from the Voices for Creative Nonviolence. It's quite amazing when you think about the cynicism, really, of U.S. foreign policy in Afghanistan, as Peter and Jeremy were outlining it. It strikes me as the height of cynicism that the United States aligns itself with really reactionary forces who are opposed to a socialist government in Afghanistan, mainly because that government wants to introduce reforms like allowing girls to read, having girls in the villages go to school. There were thousands of assassinations of teachers who had gone to the countryside during that time period. And yet the CIA was supporting these Mujahideen forces, calling them freedom fighters. Later in the 1990s, it was the Saudis and the Pakistanis, the government, both of whom were key U.S. allies, who were really funding and supporting the rise of the Taliban, who finally took power, I believe, in 1996. Talk about the cynicism, if you would, if you agree with, in fact, this narrative as being outlined.
Oh, yes, it is cynical. And I don't think that Americans understand this. My first visit to Afghanistan was in 2010. And about that time, Time magazine had a very controversial and striking cover with a picture of an Afghan woman whose nose had been cut off. And it said, what will happen if we leave to the headline was, what will happen if the U.S. leaves Afghanistan? And the Afghan women that I knew that I talked to there were furious at that, because that photograph was taken. That incident happened in an area that was under Afghan government control, controlled in effect by the U.S. occupation. This was happening under the occupation. This was happening. The perpetrators were being protected by the occupation. The occupation is not safeguarding women's rights or protecting women's rights. It's really quite the opposite. But we make this idea, selling this as a humanitarian war. And much of the criticism of the United States of the war in Afghanistan, when you hear it, is of we've been too generous, we've given too much, and we have to, with so little return. And I think this is a part of the cynicism, too. We've just a few months ago, the German government has decided that the Afghan war is over and it's safe for the Afghan refugees to return. They've stopped some 20% of the refugees leaving, entering Europe, are from Afghanistan. And the German government, among others, are saying that the war is over, it's safe to return. They're planning in the next months to be sending thousands of people, maybe thousands of children alone, back to Kabul to a situation that's simply not going to be able to it's not safe for the people who are there now to live. And it's going to be more bringing all these refugees back into that, into the chaos of and confusion that is Afghanistan. It's going to be terrible.
Yeah, Jeremy Kuzmarov, I want to ask you about the same topic. It is terrible what's happening to the refugees. You have Syrian refugees, you have Iraq refugees, you have Libyan refugees, you have Afghan refugees. Of course, there are many refugees who are coming not because the U.S. has bombed or occupied their country. They may be unemployed or impoverished because of neoliberal capitalist policies. A lot of people are on the move right now, and now because it's a political liability in Germany for the Merkel government, what Brian Terrell was talking about is just, I mean, in addition to being immoral, it's illegal in terms of the EU's own orientation on refugees. I want to ask you, Jeremy, though, because we're talking about 15 years later, the Afghan invasion. That was October 7th. The September 11th attacks happened just less than a month before that. Last week, legislation that President Obama had vetoed that would allow U.S. citizens to sue Saudi Arabia for the 9/11 attacks was brought back to life by the U.S. Congress, which overturned his veto. Since 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudis, and since the Saudis were such a principal force in bringing the Taliban to power in 1996, you would think that there would be more focus on Saudi Arabia in all of this if, in fact, it's all about stopping terrorism, if, in fact, it's all about sort of retribution, perhaps, for the 9/11 attacks, if you're really serious about the so-called war on terror. And yet the Saudis have been shielded throughout.
Yeah, I fully agree. I mean, I think now about 8 or 9 years ago, Stanley McChrystal came out and said there are less than 100, probably less than 10 al-Qaeda fighters in Afghanistan. That was, I think, around 2006. So you seriously have to question, who the U.S. is actually fighting in Afghanistan. I mean, Anand Gopal wrote a very good study of Afghanistan. He's a journalist. And he found that the United States is mostly fighting, there are a lot of these local rivalries in the countryside. and the U.S. is fighting from just local forces enmeshed in local feuds, or who've allied with the Taliban because they oppose the Karzai government and its successor and oppose foreign occupation. So the United States has just created its own enemies or is intermeshed in these local conflicts. That's why also there's a lot of civilian casualties. Sometimes they're being manipulated. You know, U.S. intelligence is being manipulated. And then I agree with you fully. I mean, the double standards of the war on terror are incredible because Saudi Arabia, I mean, Patrick Coburn wrote a wonderful book on ISIS. And, you know, he's this correspondent with the London newspapers. And he found that Saudi Arabia is a major sponsor of Sunni extremism and terrorism across the Middle East. And in line with their Wahhabi philosophy, the Saudi government has long sought to export their more extreme version of Islam that has been, you know, financing terrorism in numerous places. And as you point out, yeah, many of the hijackers came from Saudi Arabia. And of course, we also have to think about the U.S. network of military bases. I mean, what angered a lot of Saudis against the United States, what angered bin Laden, was the U.S. stationing of military bases in Saudi Arabia near Muslim holy ground, and a measure that was basically imposed by fiat by the Saudi government. So, yeah, if we're seriously concerned about fighting terrorism, we have to address why these groups turned against the United States and what the double standards are. And it's clear that Afghanistan is peripheral to the war on terror for reasons you've pointed out. And what I was suggesting, al-Qaeda had left the country, if it was there at all, on a limited extent. And it's mainly local forces that were fighting there.
Peter Kuznick, Jeremy is so right. I mean, the stationing of tens of thousands of U.S. troops after the 1991 Gulf War in Saudi Arabia was a major factor. But then you have the Saudi government sort of having carte blanche for a long time with the United States. They fueled and supported Sunni extremist al-Qaeda type forces in Iraq. They did in Libya. They are still today in Saudi Arabia. The U.S. government says it's in Afghanistan 15 years later to fight terrorism, to stop al-Qaeda or terrorist organizations like al-Qaeda. And yet in Syria, the United States government just broke off any cooperation with the Russian military in the struggle against al-Qaeda or al-Nusra or ISIL, because they say their principal problem really is the Assad government, a secular, independent nationalist government. So now the United States and Saudi Arabia are, in fact, again, going back to the position they've had since 2011, which is to foment an armed conflict in Syria with the same forces who they say they invaded Afghanistan to defeat. I mean, from like a lay person's point of view, somebody who's not paying careful attention, or even if you are paying careful attention, it seems completely schizophrenic unless you get to the sort of underlying driving force of U.S. policy. Talk about that.
Well, the situation in Syria is very, very troubling and very dangerous. Breaking off talks and negotiations with Russia now is the worst thing that can happen there. You know, and that's why I want to bring it back again to my concerns about Clinton, especially. Obama has shown some restraint in Syria. Obama, look back to the Obama's massive troop increase in Afghanistan early in his presidency. When Obama took office shortly after, he had a meeting with presidential historians. They had a dinner together, and he sought their advice. And at the end of the meeting, he went around the room, and he asked them, what is your best advice on what to do? And one after another said, don't get involved in Afghanistan. Don't get further involved in Afghanistan. And Obama was hesitant. And he asked for options from his military and political leaders. But it was Mullen, Petraeus, McChrystal, Gates, and Hillary Clinton who pushed him to send 40,000 troops to Afghanistan. Clinton was instrumental in that. On the other hand, you had Biden, Colin Powell, and a few others telling him that he didn't have to do this. But he was under a lot of pressure. He later said he got jammed when it came to Afghanistan, and he sent 30,000 troops, but he was looking for other alternatives. In Syria, again, it's Hillary Clinton who's being much more hawkish, calling for no-fly zones, for arming the opposition in ways that Obama has so far resisted. Obama's gotten attacked for supposedly letting them cross the red line and not bombing in Syria a couple of years ago. Well, I mean, That was very, very fortunate that he didn't do that. First of all, what people forget is that both houses of Congress were about to disapprove the resolution to militarily go in. That was going to be one of the great victories for the anti-war forces in decades in this country, had he gone to the Congress. And that was a strange kind of coalition of progressive anti-war forces and libertarian forces who were both fed up with American militarism. Now the narrative on that has changed dramatically. But if we go back to what was actually happening then, that policy would have been defeated because the American people were opposed to that. But so Obama has shown some restraint in Syria, but there's a lot of pressure on Obama now to actually get much more heavily involved there. And with the breaking off of talks with Russia now about that, we've created again a very dangerous situation.
We're going to have to leave it there. We're completely out of time. We've been talking about the Afghan invasion, then the Iraq invasion, then the Libya bombing, the Syria war, which may, as Peter Kuznick just said, may be on the verge of expanding. We've been talking to Peter Kuznick, Jeremy Kuzmarov, and Brian Terrell about the Afghan invasion 15 years later. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and clear.